Welcome back to another episode of The Art of Healing. I'm your host and therapist friend, Trevor Hansen. Today on the podcast, I have Morgan Bowser. Morgan is one of the most raw, real, and authentic people I have ever met. And I actually first heard Morgan speak, and I met her at a church service. She was up in front of everybody in the congregation, and she shared a really powerful story of her own life. Morgan's story is one of abuse and trial and trauma and addiction. And her story starts at a young age when she was abused both emotionally and sexually. Morgan in this podcast talks about some of the effects that came to her because of the abuse. And it's very common for people to feel shame for blaming themselves for the abuse or asking, hey, was this my fault? Because an abuser will always try to make you think that it was your fault. But Morgan dealing with these feelings of shame, some of the depressive feelings that came along with it, and all of the heavy burden that trauma puts on a life, she searched for coping mechanisms, ways to feel better. Her coping mechanism turned into her addiction, and that addiction is pornography. Morgan brings a really unique and brave approach in talking about this issue because pornography tends to be under the umbrella of a man's issue, and it can't be faced by women, and the shame of it for men and women is already so strong, but specifically more for women. So, in this episode, Morgan talks a lot about how connecting with other people, creating a support network, and being open about this issue is what helped her to heal from her addiction, and it subsequently helped her to heal from the trauma that she experienced as a child. And this is a very common theme amongst addiction recovery and specifically for addictions that are associated with shame, being able to create a support network, a group of people that you can turn to, that care about you and help you along your journey is so important. And because I know that this principle is so powerful, I have started Rise Recovery Group. It's a weekly meeting. It's a therapy group hosted at the EFT clinic, hosted by myself at the EFT clinic for single adult men who are struggling with pornography. And this is not a 12-step group. We don't call ourselves addicts. We simply look to accomplish the goals that we have in mind and tackle the issues that single adult men face, the unique issues that they face, including loneliness, wanting to excel in careers, dating, and so forth. So if you're interested, go to riserecoverygroup.com, or you can call the EFT clinic in Lehi, Utah, and they'll give you the information about Rise. And remember, you can always find more of my content on Instagram and on TikTok at The Art of Healing by Trevor. Both handles are the same. And you can find me on trevorthetherapist.com. Thank you for joining me for another episode of The Art of Healing. And again, at the time of this recording, I, Trevor Hansen, am a master's level student therapist and am not a licensed therapist. I practice therapy under the supervision of fully licensed therapists. This show is not a substitute for therapy and is not therapy.
Okay, Morgan, well, thank you so much for being here and being willing to share your story and talk about your history. I'm super glad to have you here.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for inviting me.
Absolutely. So for those of you who are listening, the reason I invited Morgan here today is because I heard her actually speak in a church service months ago. How long ago was that?
Like in August.
Yeah. It's still stuck with me. So that's how impactful it was. But I heard Morgan speak. And a lot of times when people get up, they talk about, general themes of, spirituality and whatever else. But rarely do people let us access kind of that more vulnerable part of them and share their story. And Morgan got up and she shared some really impactful pieces of her life, some of her history, some of the difficulties in her history. And so I wanted to invite her here to share some of those things today. So I heard a bit of your story before, but I'd love for you to share your story with us a little bit. Just kind of give us a high level of, where you came from. I know that you have some things that caused some trauma in your life, and now you're actually working for DCFS.
Yes.
Helping people potentially in similar situations or that have trauma, which is really inspiring, and I'd love to address that as well. But tell us a little bit about where you come from and the things that you shared with us when you spoke months ago in church.
Yeah. So I grew up kind of in a rough situation as a teenager. I dealt with different forms of abuse. I was sexually abused in my preteens by a neighbor, different things like that, as well as I dealt with a lot of emotional abuse, which is kind of a difficult thing because it doesn't leave a mark, like a physical mark that anyone can observe. And so with that, you know, it led to me like failure to thrive, trying to survive on my own as a teenager. And it led me to do a lot of things like I struggled with an addiction to pornography. I had a lot of really bad depression and anxiety growing up as a teenager. And so a lot of that, you know, just weighed really heavily on me up until, you know, I got to my young adult years and decided I wanted to make some changes and to be happy and work through all of that.
Yeah. How long did this, like, I guess these different abuses or traumas last for you? Like, when did they start? How long did they go?
Oh, probably at least a decade. I was sexually abused when I was like 11 or 12. And then from there, you know, I think when you're abused, it kind of puts you in a more vulnerable state almost. And it makes it easier for you to be identified as a target. And so I think from there, I just had a lot of interactions with people where that abuse just kind of continued throughout my teenage years. I didn't really know how to stick up for myself and to set appropriate boundaries with people and say, hey, that's not appropriate, that's not okay. Didn't really know who to turn to help in that situation. And so it was like my early 20s that, you know, I went away to college and kind of started discovering myself and realizing, you know, there were things that were happening in my life that weren't okay. Mm-hmm. And I had control to put an end to it at that point.
Wow. So it sounds like at that point, you kind of had some awareness all of a sudden that like, whoa, what I've experienced isn't normal and it's not okay.
Yeah,
Did it feel normal? Like, did you feel like this probably happens to everybody?
And I think another tricky thing about is abuse is your abuser makes you think you're the problem. So a lot of times always. I just thought, oh, well, it's just because I'm a really bad person. If I tried to be better, maybe this would end. And so I thought I had control the whole time, but I thought the control I had was me being a better person or me being more of what these people expected me to be. And so I also, you know, dealt with a lot of like perfectionism growing up. And it wasn't until I got to a place of acceptance where people were just okay with who I was and was okay when I struggled and made mistakes that I was like, oh, you know what? I still have value and people still care about me, even if I'm not perfect.
Yeah. And that's a really challenging space to be in if, you know, you're mistreated and you feel like that's your fault. And even, I don't know, for a lot of people, even when the awareness comes that says that's not my fault, logically it makes sense, but there's still some sort of weird, it's like a heavy, like emotional blanket that says like, no, it is your fault. And you feel that it's your fault, even though your brain says it's not. I don't know if you experienced any of that.
Yeah, absolutely. It was just like always conflicting back and forth. So
that's a hard place to live.
Yeah.
It's really hard. You know, you mentioned things like depression, things like, you know, added anxiety, feeling, you know, maybe on the sidelines, and especially your addiction history when it comes to pornography, because that's something that I think is often associated as just a man's problem. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, and girls absolutely struggle with that as well. Masturbation and pornography always going hand in hand, and they're very, very addictive. I mean, I think it was Sigmund Freud said the best stress reliever on the earth is orgasm. And it's like, And so I can see why it be there. But I guess how did that start for you, and what was pornography's role in your life, and how did it show up? Because it was, I would imagine, like most people, that addiction shows up in a way to try to help you.
I think, and just in my experience and conversations I've had with other females, it's a lot more common of an issue than we think, but there's a lot of shame around it. And like you said, it's just a male problem. Mm-hmm. So a lot of females don't feel like there's anyone that they can turn to. But in my conversations that I've had, I think a lot of it starts with novels. It kind of piques your interest and not quite understanding what you're reading in these romance novels. And I know, you know, they were just awkward when I would talk to adults, like, what does this mean? And, you know, it's just, especially if you're a woman, it's like, no, we don't talk about that. That's taboo. there just isn't any conversations for healthy sexuality. And I think that happens for both males and females, but it was just, I was told that's not ladylike, you know, don't talk about that kind of stuff. Don't look at that kind of stuff. And for me, it just started like with reading these books and not understanding what was going on and turning to like an innocent Google search on like my ghetto iPod touch, like right. at the time. And from there, it really just, it evolved into pictures and different things like that. And me not knowing and understanding what I was really even doing was looking at pornography.
Yeah. And how old were you when this started?
I was like 12 or 13. So I was pretty young.
Wow. Yeah. And it didn't sound like you had anybody to explain to you really, like you said, what healthy sexuality is or even some, probably I'm sure some of the terms that you ran into in these books.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And especially being Christian, it's just kind of, yeah, it's a topic we don't talk about. It's sacred. And that's, I agree with that and understand that, but it's something that it was just off the table. We don't talk about this, but being 12 or 13, your body's changing and you're curious and you want to find answers.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And so how it relates to, because I think your story is probably pretty similar to a lot of folks out there, whereas there's some sort of peak of curiosity, you know, whether it be a book or a magazine or your friend down the street shows you something, like you hear it a lot. And then there's the point where it goes from being curious and you see it once or twice and it, you know, that's exciting. And of course your endorphins are going to get going and everything else. How does it transition into something that becomes more like an addiction or something that you could consider an addiction or at least habitual? How did that happen for you?
Yeah. So for me, I mean, it got to a point where it consumed my life. I would like need to look at pornography, and especially struggling with depression, as you were just saying, like I wanted that release of endorphins. Like I wanted to feel something other than this like constant state of sadness that I was in. And so there would be times just even I, you know, sitting in school or at home where if I could not like look at pornography, I would get so irritable and ornery and just mean. And I was not myself because until I like had that, it almost was like a release of like, oh, okay. Like I was able to look and now like I feel happy and I'm good and I'm okay and can move on. But that I needed that feeling more and more. And each day it was constantly, you know, taking over my life and it was stepping in, you know, I wasn't able to focus in school or be present when I was with people or just different things like that.
Yeah. And do you say like during the height of this like addictive feeling where it became a real crutch, do you feel like you were also just in the midst of your own trauma from your own past?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, just, and that added to the shame, of just, oh, I'm not a good person. Like, because I'm doing this, this is like causing me to like be treated this way by other people. I'm a bad person. And so they really went hand in hand. And I think each fed into each other, making it more worse as it continued on.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Kind of compounding that shame that says, you know, I'm not good enough. I've done these terrible things and this is why I've been abused. You know, I caused that. And, you know, oh, here's another example of me proving that I'm not good enough because I'm looking at these things. And I know, like, you know, from our shared faith is it's not something that is in accordance with what you want to do as far as your values go.
Yeah.
And so that's got to be incredibly conflicting. Yeah. Did anybody know about this?
No. And that was another thing that made it tricky is it was very much a private in secret thing that, you know, my parents didn't know. My siblings, people who even lived with me had no clue. I was the only person. Other than obviously I had a belief that God knew and that made things more tricky that, oh, he's punishing me through these other things that are happening to me because he knows that I'm doing this behind closed doors.
So you felt like God was punishing you in other ways because of your pornography addiction.
Yeah. So a lot of my abuse, I felt like was just direct punishment. Like God was like, if you're not going to stop, I'm going to punish you just over and over again. Which just, you know, I ended up turning to pornography more. And as abuse just continued to grow, it just was a really confusing, conflicting experience for me that just, I had a lot of resentment towards myself, towards God, towards the people in my life.
That's just going to add fuel to the fire.
Yeah, absolutely.
if feelings like feeling not good enough, depression, anxiety, those, you know, they have really big labels, but they're very intricate feelings.
Yeah.
And those feelings, those are the ones driving you to, you know, we in the addiction world, they refer to it as, you know, numbing out. You mm-hmm. know, you numb that pain instead of like go to it and deal with it and whatever else. And it's just like you said, it's just going to cause you to want to act out more.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like you, I mean, if you could correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like you felt like pretty stuck. Do you feel like you were just in the washing machine, just rolling over and over again?
Absolutely. And it just seemed every time I took one step forward, it was always two steps back. Mm. It just, there, it, I never saw an end in sight.
When did that start to change? Are there certain moments or certain people or what started that change towards being able to take control?
Yeah.
Because I can imagine it's not just control of the addiction, but it's really also regarding the thing that drove you there, which is, you know, the traumatic memories, the feelings, mm-hmm. the depression, those kind of things. Teach me a little bit about how did you start to gain some traction with all of that I just mentioned? I mean, huge question.
No, you know, for me, I think the first part was getting out of the environment that I'd always been in. I chose to serve a mission for my church. And when I did that, I was put into an entirely different state. I didn't know anybody there. And so that was a big step, as well as like, it just kept me really busy doing the work that missionaries do. And when I returned home, I kind of call it my relapse phase. I hadn't dealt with the issues that were like driving that. And so I ended up getting to a place where I transferred to a different college out of state, and being in a new situation, I knew like one or two people at mm-hmm. this university. And even then, I don't feel like I knew them super well, but we, you know, I just was like, I'm just going to go for it. And that was like a really big thing, just kind of the culture shock of changing my day-to-day like patterns and having to be in a new physical environment was kind of the first step for me to be like, okay, like there's a lot of changes going on.
Right.
And I'm in control of this situation, as well as being put in a situation where I had roommates who were incredibly just awesome. And I made some really amazing friendships while I was up in Idaho at school. And those connections, and just seeing that sometimes we would get into arguments or they would get into arguments with each other, and just seeing that at the end of the day, we were all still there for each other. Mm-hmm. It really like helped me to see that, okay, like I have value and people want me in their life and they care about me and I have control over my life. And there were some things that happened that made me not feel that way. I didn't feel like I was valued or cared for, or that I was even a good person. And so seeing those two, comparing, you know, what I had thought about myself to what I was starting to think about myself, really, really helped me to begin healing that relationship that I had with myself.
Mm. You say you came home from serving your mission, and then you had that relapse phase.
Mm-hmm.
And then you, was it after that point that you made these friendships and found that connection?
Yeah. I had made a lot of these friendships when I moved up to Idaho to go to school, but some of them I had kind of known as a result of my mission, and we'd kind of had a long distance relationship. But yeah, it was really once I got up there and I was living up there and they were in my day-to-day interactions
mm-hmm.
that those friendships really evolved and really became strengthened.
Wow. I want to focus on that some more in a minute here, because I'd love to understand. I know that, you know, connection in the world of addiction recovery, they talk about connection being like the one of the biggest healers when it comes to healing from these addictive behaviors. But I'm also curious, how did that feel to come home after, you know, being clean from your addiction for a long time, you know, doing good things that whole time? You know, you probably felt pretty great mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. And then when that relapse happened, like, what did you feel and think when that happened?
I was really disappointed in myself. Like, just, I can't even describe the shame. Like, I've made jokes a lot this year, like, oh, COVID has nothing on me. 2017 was the worst year of my life. It was really hard. I had a lot of resentment towards God and to the people around me, but especially to myself. And it really just caused me to feel like I'm so inherently bad. Like, I just felt like I was a burden to my family and to my friends. And it just made me angry. And I would try to push them away because I just thought, no, I have to be noble. I have to push you away. And so it was a really like lonely, difficult time for me because really the only person I could rely on due to my actions was myself. And I hated myself. So I just was kind of just trying to get through life the best that I could.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a hard place to be because it's funny, the things that we think of in the middle of something like that, in the middle of addiction, are literally the solutions that we think of tend to be the opposite of what we need. You know, you're talking about pushing your family away or your friends away. And it's interesting. You said you needed to be noble and push them away. How did that, I mean, it has some twisted logic in there, right? And because the addiction is going to try to hold on to you and twist your logic however it wants. Mm-hmm. But what was the logic behind, I got to push them away because of what's going on?
Yeah, I think I just felt like, oh, if they knew mm-hmm. what I was doing behind closed doors, they wouldn't want to be my friend. And so part of it, I think, was a protection to myself. Like, if I push you away, then I have control over the situation. You can't push me away because I already did it. Mm-hmm. But I think part of it too was just, you know, in the Christian world, you know, I felt like, oh, God's going to judge me based off of my actions. And I'm just such a bad person. I don't want to bring the people in my life that I care about down. And I don't want them to have to suffer consequences because of choices that I make. And so it was just, I'm just going to push them away because I care about them and they need to be free. And this is just my path.
And it sounds like connection. It's funny because you talked about how you had the thought of pushing people away, and that was the solution in your mind for a time. Like, hey, I got to protect myself because them knowing is not safe, and I don't want to be disappointing them because if they're disappointed, they're not safe in a way. Like, and then it sounds like connection actually became the solution itself.
Absolutely.
So it's the opposite. So tell me about those relationships, because you said that they've made you feel important and made you feel loved and seen for the first time and valued. But what did they do to make that environment possible? And what did you do? Because it sounds like you had to change something. You were pushing people away. You weren't letting them in. Like, what did you do to open yourself for healing through connection?
Well, I think a lot of it first started with a relationship with myself, with Morgan. I started taking myself out on, I call them self dates. Uh-huh. And it's just because a lot of the time I spent alone, it was triggering. And then I would look at pornography. And so if I had pockets of time where I was alone, I was like, okay, I need to be out doing something away from the environment that causes me to view pornography. And so a lot of times I would spend time with myself and becoming more independent, moving to a different state on my own, doing all these things kind of just made me feel more confident in who I was. And I started meeting my needs and realizing, like, okay, like, why do you want to look at pornography? You're feeling lonely. So why don't we go out and like chat with your roommates? And just putting myself out there. And it got to a point where I started opening up with some of them because I needed accountability and I needed support. And I would say, hey, I'm struggling with this and it's not something I'm proud of and I want to change it in my life because it's really affecting me in these ways. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm home alone and I'm doing homework, I'm probably going to keep my door open as a way to be accountable. Or if I'm really struggling, I might just come out and just sit and do homework. And if you're doing homework, you don't have to talk to me. It's okay. But I might just need somebody there. And a lot of times my roommates would just, you know, they would know and they would follow up and like, how are you doing? Like, what can I do to support you? And sometimes they would drop stuff to go out with me and just get out of the house to do something. And there were just a lot of times where I would cry and share like the deepest, most vulnerable feelings I had that I'd never shared with anybody. And they just sat there and listened. And I remember I would always go to bed and think, oh, crap, well, I ruined that friendship. Like, no way they're going to want to be friends with me after I just like divulged all of that on them. Right. But they were there. They showed up. And, you know, that friend group evolved over time. You know, more friends from church came in and people from classes. And it became just this big group. And they started struggling, too, with different things in their life. And just watching all of my friends run to support them. And then they would support me and we'd support this person. And just it was just so like healing for me to see, okay, like I'm not the only person that struggles. Like everybody struggles. And the fact that this friend of mine who I love so dearly is struggling doesn't change the fact that I love them or care about them. I want to be there for them to help them. And I deserve that in my life too. So it's okay that I'm not perfect. And it's okay that I have all this trauma and these difficult things and behaviors that came from my trauma. They still love me and they want to support me to becoming the version of myself that I want to be.
Wow. I love that, because as you were thinking, I was thinking about the reciprocal causality of the addiction itself, where you do that which makes you feel less than or stressed or angry or whatever else, and you reach to pornography. And yet it sounds like you created a new cycle, even a new culture within your house, which was a culture of vulnerability and healing one another through the sharing those experiences. You know, you shared, they became more vulnerable to share their own. And I'm going to guess, but my guess is that you reaching out to them in their times of need probably also helped you with your own stuff.
Oh yeah. I would guess. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, as you were saying that, I just thought of Brené Brown, and she talks about how vulnerability is what makes connection. And I think connection is what makes healing. And so, you know, I just think even now, like I've moved back to Utah and some of my friends, I have a friend in New Mexico and California, and some of them are still in Idaho. We're scattered, but we still have found ways to be there for each other. And, you know, whether it's just in a group text, like, hey, I'm really struggling, this is going on. Even this week, I've had a difficult kind of family situation. And normally I would really keep that to myself. But I was like, hey, guys, I need a reminder, like, that I am a good person, that I'm valued, like, this is what's going on. And I just need some support right now. And, you know, I've had friends that have done that to me too in that group. They've just reached out, and we've just been able to like foster that connection more and more despite the physical distance between us. And that's just been like a really, really powerful thing moving forward.
Yeah. And it sounds like a powerful relationship or a little tribe that you have now, which I love.
Yeah.
But I'm going to guess that it wasn't easy to get that started. What was that like to talk to the first roommate about this problem, you know, this man's problem, you know, this pornography problem, the thing that you've been buried in shame for so long, and yet it's time to tell somebody and, you know, be honest, be accountable. What was that like? Was it scary? Was it easy? Could have been easy. I don't know, maybe. But tell me about how that started.
Yeah, it definitely was not easy. you know, I had a lot of fears. My room roommate at the time, I didn't even really know her. I'd never met her before. And I just thought, oh, great. She's going to be like, this is who I got stuck with rooming for during the semester. And so I was scared of that rejection. I'd faced a lot of rejection before. And, you know, this isn't true. But there's kind of this ideal in Christianity that if you sin, you're being rejected by God. And so I just thought, ugh, what am I like putting myself up to? Why am I doing this? But I just felt like within my heart, that was what I needed to do. And the like amount of love and respect that she showed to me, and she shared experiences from her life and her past that really caused us to connect. And she really was the first person that just kind of showed me that like, it's okay. Like we all have things like that we don't want other people to know, things that we'd bury in the closet. But just having her know, it felt so refreshing because I didn't have to make up weird excuses with why I had to keep the door open if I was in the room alone, or why I was kind of being a little feisty and angry and different things like that, or why I was going to meetings every week. Like I was able to just be open and honest, and that gave me a safe place because of her reaction to feel like, okay, I think there are other people who would probably be equally understanding. And that just evolved from roommate, you know, to another roommate, and then a friend and a friend, and this friend group, you know, it took like a year and a half for us all to come together. But by the end, you know, I had conversations with each of them personally and privately, but all together. And we just really were able to foster that group of vulnerability, but healing and support and just love.
Wow. That's awesome. And it sounds like it put you in a space where, I mean, the stress of the addiction itself tends to fuel the addiction in a way. The stress of keeping it secret and being being secretive about, oh, I'm just going to a meeting, you know, and they're like, what is this, you know, and just having that relaxed space, that safe space where you can be like, yeah, I'm going to go to an addiction recovery meeting tonight. And you're met with love. That's really powerful to be able to, yeah, be in a space where you feel that people care about the deepest parts of you.
Yeah.
And they care about not just, oh, how was your day? Oh, you had a hard day at work. Like, you know, there's that kind of love. And then there's the, like, your real pain. And when people can hold that and still love you equally, I think that is extremely powerful. And it gives, I'm speaking for my own self now, but it gives me, when people can see my most wounded pieces, the pieces that I'm not very okay with, I'm more ashamed of, and they can hold those pieces and say, hey, Trev, like, I love you just as much, if not more, because of the tenderness that it causes in them to love you. Like, that gives you reason to live.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It does. Yeah. And I think in the midst of a shameful type of addiction, feeling like you have worth or that you have reason to live sometimes can be scarce.
Yeah.
And that's why there are, you know, commonly in those situations, thoughts of self-destructive thoughts, you know, suicidal ideations and all sorts of things. But having that connection, I think, is so, so very important. You talked about how there you had some more mindfulness, it sounds like. You were more aware of your feelings because you said, oh, I'm feeling lonely, and sometimes loneliness will lead me to act out on my addiction, so I'm going to do this instead. How did that principle of mindfulness and being able to know what's going on inside of you help you conquer the physical side of addiction?
Yeah. And like you said, like, I had felt stuck for so long, like just in the washing machine, nothing was working. And it was actually in a class that I was taking at school. I have a degree in marriage and family studies, and I was taking a parenting class. They were talking about this idea of emotional coaching. And I just had this thought, like, what have I emotionally, like, coached myself? Like, can I do that? Would that even work? I don't know.
Definitely.
Right? And it did. I just, in those moments where I could tell I was feeling something negative, I would just try to take a step back, take a couple deep breaths, and be like, okay, Morg, what are you feeling? And I would just have to ask myself, like, a lot of whys to really get to the root of the problem and be like, oh, okay. So you're feeling angry because you're scared of being rejected, but you're feeling lonely. That's the problem. So what do we need to do to fix that? Like, why don't you go and try and make a connection with your roommate? Well, you're scared to do that. Why? Oh, because you feel like you're going to be rejected. And just really taking that time to find out what I was feeling caused me to know the actions that I could do to take control over those feelings to change it. Because I can't change my environment. You can't change life, no, unfortunately.
It just happens to you.
But the way that you react is something you have control over. And that really empowered me to start taking those moments of mindfulness and being like, hey, what are you feeling? What can you do in this moment to change that?
That sounds, to somebody who's never done that sounds kind of hard to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it can be difficult. And it was. It's something that I still struggle with even like 3 years later.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, just starting with what am I feeling? And it just those basic emotions of I'm feeling angry. Okay, well, why do I feel angry? Because this happened. Well, why did that happen? Whatever. I always ask myself why. Why? I just keep asking myself that until I have no other explanation. And I find when I hit that point, it's like, okay, this is what we need to focus on. And that's what we need to fix.
And as you did that, especially in the early stages, as you repeated that, would you find patterns that were informing you so that it became easier in the future? I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I found for me, a lot of it came down to fear of like rejection, self-rejection, loneliness. A lot of it was the same for me. And, you know, I've conquered those battles, but even now, you know, I've changed, but life is still hard.
Yeah.
And I still, a lot of times I find, okay, like this is what I'm struggling with right now. This is a constant pattern. And what do we need to do to change that? So that moving forward, you know, and that's just part of life, is we're always going to be evolving and life is always changing and our situations are going to be changing. And sometimes it's going to be really good, but sometimes it's going to suck. And that's just part of life. And I think really learning to be in tune with ourselves and what we need in those moments is really important.
Yeah. Well, you've done some tremendous work, obviously, because you know, your biggest fears have to do with rejection, mm-hmm. and, you know, what if people knew, kind of thing. And yet you're here sharing a very, very vulnerable story for the good of others. And so it shows this immense progress. I mean, mm-hmm. if you were to look back at yourself, you know, how many odd years ago, and, you know, maybe yourself back then is watching you now and being like, whoa, no, stop. Like,
yeah, definitely. She'd be freaking out.
Like, hold on, put on the brakes. But, and for our listeners, those who might be dealing with a similar struggle or know somebody who is, you know, I first was going to word the question to say, what would you tell them? But I'm also curious, if you were to talk to Morgan, you know, pre-mission or right after the mission, when the relapse happened, when she's in the middle of it all, the difficult feelings of trauma, the depression, the anxiety, the loneliness, the addiction, and the shame that comes from that, what would you tell her?
Oh, I think first off, I would tell her how proud I am. I was really hard on myself in my teenage years, and looking back, I still did a lot of really awesome things and did a lot of good. And I often failed to recognize that because I was so hyper-focused on the bad that I did. But I think I would also just tell myself to take a deep breath. It's okay. You're human. Everyone else around you is making mistakes too. And it doesn't seem like that because I think we all tend to keep those hidden as much as possible, those skeletons in our closet, because we don't want people to reject us. But I would just encourage her to open up and be confident in who she is and foster those connections by saying, hey, I make mistakes and I struggle and I feel angry and I feel sad sometimes. Because most of the times those conversations are like, oh my gosh, me too. Like, let me tell you about this mistake that I made and how it still torments me to this day. Or I feel really angry when people do this too. And just reminding her that, you know, we're all just trying the best that we can. And when we're vulnerable, it really just opens our eyes to the fact that nobody around us is perfect and that's okay.
Absolutely. No, and that's super beautiful. And I appreciate you sharing that with us. I also, as you were speaking, I thought of, you know, stories that I have heard where mm-hmm. at times opening up like that doesn't go as well as they plan. Mm-hmm. Had you ever had that experience where you shared with somebody and it wasn't well received?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And at least in my experience, that has been more rare. So I try to focus on when people are positive and mm-hmm. have those good reactions. But it's important to note that, you know, sometimes we're going to open up and share those deep parts of ourselves and it's going to be too much for someone. And that can be really hard because it's like, oh, you're rejecting me and everything that I am. And I think you just have to, you know, push through those moments, understand that it's like an outlier.
Yeah.
Most of the time. I think it's okay to grieve that loss and that rejection, but it gets to a point where, you know, not necessarily move on, but you have to move forward and just know that, you know, there are going to be people that are going to be put in your path that you're going to be able to make those connections with that are going to accept the fact that you're not perfect and that you have things that you struggle with that you're trying to hide and that are going to want to support you through those things.
I think it's really important to note that, yeah, most people are going to be loving and accepting. And it's also encouraged to be really wise as to who you are sharing that with. You know,
yeah.
these are really vulnerable and sacred parts of a person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our struggles that we have in the dark and our pains. And so I think wisely testing those friendships and those relationships and making sure that it is a safe place, because you don't want to put yourself in a spot that, you know, if you don't, you can live through it, but you would rather not
yes.
share with somebody that's going to be rejecting or that's not going to be respectful of that. Mm-hmm. And so for anybody who is listening, is thinking about becoming open about this and finding the healing that you have, I would just encourage them to really seek after people who give signs of safety, those who are welcoming of other maybe smaller problems or are always there to listen and things like that, because that's where to start.
Yeah, I agree. Trust takes time, and sometimes we just have to be patient and let those friendships get to a point where we do trust them with that kind of information.
Yeah. Well, Morgan, I really have appreciated you being here so much. It's honestly been phenomenal. I knew it was going to be good. Didn't know it was going to be this
You're
good.
Kind.
Is there any last thing that you'd like to share with anybody out there who maybe hears this and relates to your story?
Just that you're not alone. I feel like it's the cliche thing to say at the end of a podcast or video or whatever, but you're not alone. And I think it's important to note that, because the second you recognize that, it really just pulls you out from this state of isolation, which really feeds addiction and trauma and things like that, and puts you into a state, and it's a vulnerable state where you can get hurt, but it's also a state where you can heal.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again, Morgan. Yeah. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Again, for those who are interested in learning about Rise Recovery Group, please go to riserecoverygroup.com or just send me a message on Instagram at The Art of Healing by Trevor, and I'm sure to respond and we'll have a conversation. Thank you again for tuning in to another episode of The Art of Healing. At the time of this recording, I, Trevor Hansen, am not a licensed therapist. I practice therapy under the supervision of fully licensed therapists. This show is not a substitute for therapy and is not therapy.